giant.
So, on behalf of my fellow panel members, would like to welcome you and express our appreciation for your attendance here at this panel discussion entitled Homemaking Radicalism, Homemaking Realities. This is a panel that was originally put together by Russell Fox and originally presented without my help. We'll call that the superior version. At the Midwest Sunstone just this last April. And I had the privilege of watching the panel, and the other attendees had the privilege of watching a panel that I wasn't speaking in. The impetus for Russell's desire to put together the panel was a book by Shannon Hayes entitled Radical Homemakers. The author is not Mormon and doesn't, as far as I know, interview any Mormons involved in radical, agrarian, localist, sustainable, non-consumerist homemaking in the course of the book. I'm going to read a couple of paragraphs that Russell, who also sends his regrets for not being able to either be here himself or to manage the technical requirements for sending a video introduction. last second emailed me a couple of paragraphs by way of introduction. He writes, "The book inspired me to look at my own church community, at the way the idea of making a home, with all the usual tropes about food storage, economic sustainability, and provident living, has been used, encouraged, contributed to, and sometimes been burdened with obstacles. I wanted to get people thinking in a deep and radical way about their own personal journey towards homemaking, about the history, politics, psychology, as well as the economics, which go into the construction and definition of a home. I was fortunate enough to have some thoughtful friends who were willing to take the topic and run with it they did." And I just note here that in my place, the original version of this panel included Chris Hendrickson, who is a gentleman and a scholar. "The papers you're going to hear," this is still Russell's introduction, "the papers you're going to hear and the comments and questions in connection to them, which Brad Kramer will provide, do not follow in any thoroughgoing sense the sort of critique of American capitalism and domestic consumerism which Hayes presented in her book. But at the heart of Hayes' project is getting people to see that homes are sources of production, not just consumption. That homes are resources for community and integrity, but not automatic ones. That homes, and specifically making homes, place enormous and rarely evenly divided burdens on those who pursue them. But the rewards for making one, for making a home, are profound, not just socially, but spiritually as well. In other words, the notion of looking at homemaking in both a radical and realistic manner invites us to stop viewing the home as a neutral, defined category of thought and action, but rather as an ongoing project. One which both invites and challenges us and our church community as we try to find our own ways and try to consider how best to teach about the value of this always evolving ideal. Enjoy the papers you're going to hear and think about them. I certainly did." So that's Russell's introduction. We are going to hear first from me, right?
Yeah.
First from me. Followed by Christine. Am I on the right track here?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And followed by Christian?
Yes.
Followed by Tracy. So,
process of elimination.
Enjoy the panel. There will be time for, I'll probably close with a few, remarks or questions or something, whatever Russell had in mind. I'll figure it out over the course of the panel. Something to springboard some conversation, because I think there should be time for some questions and back and forth. So, without further ado, I am going to go into my presentation.
We got it.
You got it?
Yeah.
He's so subtle. So this is my presentation. This is the only slide. I didn't do a PowerPoint. I'm just going to read sort of old school academic presentation style. But this is the title, Politics and the Family of Reef Disquisition on Human Nature. Today I wish to fix some critical attention on the now familiar Mormon admonition that successes in the world cannot compensate for failures in the home. What are the key differences between our family lives and our lives outside in the world? Why is what happens in our homes and families so much more important than what happens outside, in our work, in our civic participation, even in our church service? I believe the answers Mormonism provides to these questions are made clearest against the backdrop of modern political philosophies and economic theories, and what they tend to presume about human nature. These presumptions are taken as the foundational truths upon which our entire system of life and philosophical traditions which sustain it are built, from politics and education to economics and recreation. These two presumptions, these two axiomatic truths, are as follows. First, the first great truth, which I intend to challenge with my little presentation here. Truth number one, human beings are inherently greedy and depraved, avaricious and contentious, ruthless and animal-like in their pursuit of self-interest. Truth number two is related to it and builds upon it. And it is that unless the unruly human animal is somehow governed, it will reduce the world to absolute anarchy. It must be governed by either a system of monarchical domination, in which natural human self-interest is restrained by an external power, or by a self-organizing system of free and equal powers, in which the opposition of particular interests regulates and reconciles them to the common interest. These two ideas of a depraved human nature and of the necessity of governing it through either authoritarian hierarchy or oppositional equilibrium, debatable though they are, nevertheless run like a red thread through our philosophical heritage and not only underlie our modern political order, but constitute a totalizing metaphysical order. The anthropologist Marshall Solins has devoted a great deal of research and analysis to unpacking the historical development of our modern political ontologies. His recently published The Western Illusion of Human Nature lays out the case in impressive detail, and here I'll just briefly canvas his work in order to set the stage for an argument about what, if anything, Mormonism has to say about politics, family relationships, and human nature. Solins begins, appropriately, with Plato, who spoke in the Republic of, quote, the self-advantage which every creature by nature pursues. Aristotle described human nature in similarly lurid terms. Quote, appetite is by nature unlimited, and the majority of mankind live for the satisfaction of appetite. Aristotle continues, describing man as a, quote, wild animal, for appetite is like a wild animal, and passion warps the rule of the best men. Hesiod believed that in the absence of imposed justice, people would literally devour one another. Quote, wretched and godless, cheat their parents, destroy each other's towns. In Hesiod's account of the universe, there is no order without supremacy and hierarchy. Thus, humankind had to have its nature subdued by Zeus and the gods. Thucydides described a violent civil war at Corcyra in which humanity's depraved nature was on full display. Here's a quote. Human nature, always rebelling against law and now its master, gladly showed itself, ungoverned, above respect for justice, the enemy of all. The cause of all these evils, he continued, was the lust for power arising from greed and ambition, and from these passions proceeded violence. He also asserted that humanity was destined to forever repeat such tragic sufferings, quote, so long as human nature remained the same. Thucydides' account is significant, not just in the detail with which it describes humanity's natural depravity, but for its influence. The political philosopher Thomas Hobbes would be the first to translate Thucydides' work into English, and the Greek historian's vision of human nature would directly shape Hobbes' defense of authoritarian government as a check against it. Thucydides' account would also influence John Adams, who would propose a decidedly different solution to the exact same problem. Before looking at Hobbes and Adams in more detail, Solins describes a strong and influential medieval tradition in which humanity's wildly avaricious nature was wedded to the doctrine of original sin. Here our contemptible and ferociously self-interested nature was explained as a consequence of the fall, of the disobedience of our first parents. As inheritors of this depraved nature, we also share culpability for it. The solution to the problem of culpability is baptism, preferably quickly after birth, to remove the stain of original sin. And the solution to the threat that human savagery would continue to rear its ugly head even after baptism was, of course, monarchical power, kingly rule by divine right. Medieval thinkers from Augustine and Aquinas to Dante and St. John Chrysostom. Chrysostom actually wrote that if you took away our rulers, quote, we would live a life less rational than animals biting and devouring each other. These thinkers tie our shared natural depravity with the transgression of Adam and Eve, as well as to the need for authoritarian rule. Such thinking reached its apogee with Hobbes, who in Leviathan described the human state of nature in which we are all permanently at war with all. Hobbes' solution was a uniquely powerful sovereign who would hold the human race in perpetual awe and check our natural dispositions with fearful coercion. John Adams accepted Hobbes, and by extension Thucydides' dismal view of human nature, but proposed an alternative solution. Drawing on a philosophical tradition which borrowed from the experience of early medieval republics of Italy, as well as emerging traditions in the Anglo-American Enlightenment, and particularly reaching into the classical tradition, Adams argued, in an essay entitled All Men Would Be Tyrants If They Could, that all men would be tyrants if they could. Here's a quote. Every man who has ever read a treatise upon morality or conversed with the world must have often made the observation that the selfish passions are stronger than the social, that the former would always prevail over the latter in any man left to the natural emotions of his own mind, unrestrained and unchecked by other power extrinsic to himself, end quote. The solution was a government of counterbalancing powers. As opposing interests clashed and competed, their destructive dispositions would be transformed into beneficial effects. Adams advocated a republican form of mixed government, reserving sovereignty to the people after the manner of Athenian democracy, but combining democracy, oligarchy, and monarchy into a single system. The power of the popularly elected lower house would be counterpoised against that of the natural aristocracy of wealth in the Senate, with both opposed by a single executive authority. Each of these powers, if left alone, would resort to tyranny, but poised against one another, the resulting opposition and rivalry would produce domestic tranquility. A similar view of the generally beneficent effects of individual self-interest was laid out on the plane of economic production and commerce rather than politics on the eve of the American Revolution by Adam Smith. His was a world in which the aggregate effects of the pursuit of individual self-interest on the part of all would work like a great invisible hand or invisible God to the benefit of all as well as to the maximal production of wealth. It is worth noting that much as we are conditioned to believe that there are enormous differences between our current political and economic ideologies, and as much as the parties involved would like to claim Smith and Adams as their exclusive intellectual heritage, the fact is that politics and economics today in the West are debated well within the parameters laid out by these two great thinkers. I have presented this admittedly oversimplified history, if only to illustrate the degree to which the notion of a relentless, aggressive, self-interested, and self-aggrandizing human nature has taken root in our collective imagination. Yet alternatives do exist, conceptions of the human condition undreamed of in our received philosophies of human nature. If the received wisdom revolves around self-interest, what then does it mean when the terms self and interest apply not to individuals, but to transpersonal relationships? Kinship, family relations, represent an entirely different plane of human action and interaction in which the conventional myths of a depraved and self-interested human nature have no obvious place or purchase. Family and kindred relations are the source of our most meaningful experiences, our deepest sentiments, and our most lasting attachments. They govern who we are in ways that our economic and political relations could never dream to match. Our modern ideas about human nature are in fact culturally specific, though it is a spreading culture, and the productions of our particular histories. Yet kinship is the one true universal of human sociality. One would think that our notions of human nature would begin at home, in our families, yet that would yield something far removed from self-interest, since family is the place where charity truly obtains. There is some acknowledgement of this in our intellectual and philosophical tradition as well. Both Plato and Augustine described ideal human societies as ones based on kinship. Greater yet was Aristotle's formulation of kinship as the basis for all human social relations in Nicomachean Ethics. This is a long quote. Parents, then, love their children as being themselves, for those sprang from them are, as it were, their other selves of theirs, resulting from the separation. Children love parents as being what they have grown from, and brothers each other by virtue of their having grown from the same source. For the self-sameness of their relation to those produces the same with each other. They are, then, the same entity in a way, even though in different subjects. End quote. Kinship is a mutual relationship of being. Family members are in a very real sense members of one another. If you are a member of my family, then my relationship to you is intrinsic to my own existence. The self is something that exists not just within you as a discrete entity, but is diffused among those most closely related to you. A part of yourself exists, not just metaphorically, but in reality, within others. In a universe characterized by familial relationships, there is no such thing as self-interest in the modern political or economic sense of the term. Kinship and kindness have the same roots. We participate in one another's being. We share purpose and essence. Familiar relationships also defy the basic logic of our modern politics and economics in other key ways. Whereas the latter focus so much attention on the rational pursuit of self-interest and the imperatives of efficient productivity, family life is utterly different. We commit the resources and time and energy we do into our family responsibilities with no regard for rational calculation, for a measurable return on our investment, or for something like efficiency. Maybe when it comes to things like household chores, we strive for a degree of efficiency, but when it comes to the serious work, to teaching our children what they need to navigate the world, to cultivating strong, loving bonds between spouses, to instilling values, to pursuing happiness together, to caring for those we love and ensuring that they feel our love, when it comes to these pursuits, our successes and failures, and there are always both, are not measurable with the logic of accounting, of returns on investment, of efficiency or workplace productivity. These are the most important, most fulfilling, most meaningful things we will do in this world, and they utterly defy the logic of rational, efficient pursuit of self-interest. They reveal in us our true nature, a nature starkly alternative to that imagined in our political culture or our debates over economic policy. Mormonism, finally, tells us a completely different story about who we are, our nature, and our destiny. It tells us, in the first place, that there is no original sin, that our competitive, ruthless, self-interested dispositions were not inherited from our fallen first parents, but were taught to humanity by Satan, who convinced Cain that any act, even one which took innocent life, was justified if it led to an increase in property. Cain, who was not his brother's keeper in their competitive dog-eat-dog world, gloried in his victory as he took possession over Abel's property. He claimed that it made him free, as we are all taught to equate the control of property with freedom, and increased property with increased freedom. The Mormon gospel teaches us that we are to understand ourselves first and foremost in terms of familial relationships, as sons and daughters of Abraham, of Adam and Eve, and of heavenly parents. Adam never refers to him as God, but only always simply as Father. We are taught that our family ties define who we are and define who we will become, that families not only can be together forever, but must be together forever. We are taught, like Enos of old, that the love and charity which obtains within a family should extend outward in an expanding circle that encompasses not just our friends and allies, but even our enemies. We are taught that priesthood is, at its core, the power to forge, through sealing, familial bonds stronger than those which arise from our natural genetic ties. And we are taught that kinship bonds can extend beyond our natal families, outward in space and backward and forward in time. In our effort to quietly forget the fact that Joseph Smith spent the latter years of his life multiplying his marital relationships, we have completely forgotten that the prophet kings of bygone Mormonism routinely had men adopted to them as sons. Whatever the source of our inability to fully understand now what Joseph was doing then, he clearly felt that marital and parental bonds on earth most closely approximate the kinds of relationships which obtain among and between all beings who participate in celestial order, and he believed that part of that order could be extended into this earthly experience. Remember when Jesus was asked about his family, he pointed to his disciples and said, "Here they are." Family relations are defined by a self that exists not just within you, but inside others. And we are taught not only to love others as we love ourselves, but that perfect love will transform us in such a way that when we encounter Christ, we will see ourselves in Him, see who we really are, our image in His countenance as His is in ours. We are taught that the true nature and purpose of our existence lies not in the great and spacious high-rise of the world, but in the radically different reality on the other side of the yawning gulf, where it wasn't enough for Lehi to experience the love of God alone, without his family with whom he longed to share it. Finally, the religion of Joseph Smith resoundingly rejects theologies and philosophies which reduce us to our basis of impulses and debase our potential. It teaches us that we can discover and build upon our true nature and true potential by submitting, not as a vile sinner to a contemptuous authoritarian God, but as a child submits to a father. It is in our homes, in our family lives and family relationships, and in the extension of these bonds outward into the world that we find our truest selves. If this paper has a bottom line argument directly related to the topic of the panel, it is that any call for truly radical homemaking must recognize at the outset the full implication of what it means to make our homes and our family lives more important than our worldly experience, our home and our family selves more important than our worldly selves, that the real power of the atonement to transform us into a celestial community begins when we define ourselves first and foremost as kin, as members of the same family, as descendants of the same lineage, where, as in the sealing room and on the page of the patriarchal blessing, the dominant metaphor for human sociality is infinite kinship, and, most importantly, where the metaphor is also real. Thank you.
So as my slightly melodramatic title, which does, however, have the virtue of being less pompous than Brad's, suggests.
Less pompous than me isn't exactly a virtue.
I think there's nothing radical about Mormon homemaking as currently practiced, and particularly as currently envisioned as the manifestation of women's essential nature and the most righteous roles she may perform. Notions about home, and in particular about motherhood and homemaking, have both reflected and informed Mormon doctrine and practice, and the degree to which Mormon anxiety is about the church's participation in the public sphere, being in the world, have been by turns assuaged and amplified by constructing an idealized domestic sphere presided over by women. So this morning I want to take a ridiculously broad, sloppy romp, although not as ridiculously broad and sloppy as Brad.
Not several millennia.
Not starting with Plato. Through the history of how domestic life has figured in the involvement of North American Mormons with the surrounding society. Armin Moss's articulation of the need for new religious groups to create optimal tension with the host society is a useful way to think through some of these questions. So in the early Utah period, pre-statehood, the tension with the outside society was created by war with federal government. It's pretty tense, over theocracy and social controversy over polygamy, as well as geographical distance, obviously. The fight over polygamy rendered the private and domestic exquisitely public and political. And Mormons spent so much time defending the fundamental structure of their families to the outside world that there was little rhetorical energy left over for prescriptions about the content of domestic life. Both men and women were implicated in resisting the capitalist, individualist, corporate modes of modernity, as were the public and private spheres in roughly equal proportions. Women were responsible for maintaining cooperative, polygynous homes, while men were engaged in creating cooperative economic and political structures. But after the end of polygamy and the assimilation or dissolution of Deseret into Utah, the resistance to modernity was maintained only within the private sphere, and it became gendered. It was women who accomplished the transition from polygamous to monogamous Mormon families, and who then preserved remnants of the communitarian economy in their relief society and primary work. Ironically, these civic efforts of women were modeled on a form of civic involvement that had been influential in the anti-polygamy crusades of the late 19th century. One editorial writer had, in fact, described the anti-polygamy protests as being comprised of, quote, every known society from the Young Men's Sewing Circle of Cranberry, Wisconsin, to the Heavyset Ladies Glee Club of New York. Mormon women adopted the rhetoric and habits of what was by then the fading culture of women's clubs and benevolent societies, championing the belief that women's moral purity should exercise a civilizing influence in the political realm. They made the tenets of early first-wave feminism into religious principles, elevating sentimentality about motherhood and housekeeping to the level of theological axioms. One of my favorite places where you see this is in some of the primary songs that show up early on. There's a particular favorite of mine called Washing Dishes that says, in a right way or a wrong way, washing dishes may be done. We will show you now the right way that the battle may be won. Righteous dishwashing.
You made that up.
I didn't, I swear. But this femininity still had a place in Mormon communal life. The list of civic societies Amy Brown Lyman, for instance, who was involved in the general presidency of the Relief Society from 1928 to 1945, for instance, belonged to or chaired, was long enough that the heavyset women's singing circle might well have been hidden amongst the social reform organizations which she belonged to or chaired. Mormons believed, long after most of the country had ceased to, that women's moral purity made them particularly suited to participation in civic life. Let me say that again, because it's important. Mormons believed that women's moral purity made them particularly suited to participation in civic life outside the home. By the late 1950s, geographic isolation was less potent in maintaining group cohesion, and there were no more wars with the federal government. And the Mormon family starts to look a lot like American That's families, right. But always with one more child. The Mormon birth rate tracks the national one with one more child added. This is the moment that Moss identifies as the point where the pendulum had swung as far towards assimilation as the group could tolerate and still remain coherent. Here's his description. Mormons of the 1960s were generally a highly assimilated group of Americans. In educational attainment, occupational status, and community size of origin, it would have been difficult to distinguish most Mormons from others. In civic and political attitudes, too, Mormons were already well within the American mainstream. With some variation in party preferences among the Mormon samples, they were all generally quite close to their non-Mormon neighbors. In the specific domestic and foreign policy issues of the time, there was as much diversity among Mormons as among others, suggesting that civic and political attitudes were not much informed by religious beliefs or commitments. The main tendency of Mormon views was neither very liberal nor very conservative, but quite centrist and moderate. Only in the realm of lifestyle did we see evidence of lagging assimilation. Maybe not lagging, but Moss also points out that Mormon peculiarity has always been important, on a mythic level at least, to Mormons. And so the idea that Mormons were different has always been strenuously maintained in rhetoric, if not always in fact, as he points out about the late 50s and early 60s. So the decade of the 60s, broadly, and feminism particularly, provided new sources of tension against which Mormonism could define itself. Here, too, though, the locus of resistance is coded feminine, and again, it reaches back for older ideas about femininity, preserving the anomalous post-war middle-class Mormon family overlaid with Victorian sentimentality as Mormonism's last form of resistance to complete assimilation. Ironically, women's moral purity, which in the early days of Utah statehood had been adduced to explain women's particular suitability for involvement in civic life, is now marshaled as an argument that women should not be sullied by involvement in the dirty world of business and politics. Mormon women are once again, however, charged with maintaining and demonstrating Mormon peculiarity. Church President Spencer W. Kimball made this explicit when he said, much of the major growth that is coming to the church in the last days, and every woman in here has heard this a million times, will come because many of the good women of the world, as opposed to the evil, unmaternal others with whom he had contrasted women in the preceding paragraphs, that part's not a quote, will be drawn to the church in large numbers. This will happen to the degree that the women of the church reflect righteousness and articulateness in their lives, and to the degree that the women of the church are seen as different and distinct in happy ways from the women of the world. The insistence of second-wave feminism that the personal is political seems to have driven Mormon women to abandon all political and civic involvement as a mode of resistance. Rather than the public resistance to modern American capitalism and individualism that characterized the early Utah period, and in which women and men participated together, the resistance to cultural trends of the 60s was left almost entirely to women, who were expected to maintain and defend a calcified domesticity, while Mormon men were encouraged to participate fully in American corporate life. Men, too, were taught that no other success can compensate for failure in the home, so that the pressures of providing and new insistence on paternal involvement in sentimentalized domestic life, see the collected sermons of President McKay, for instance, left little room for civic participation. Moreover, the every member a missionary mantra rendered all interactions with non-Mormons potential opportunities for conversion, so that what civic life there was tended to be subsumed by religious sensibilities. The migration of Mormons out of Utah matters here, too. Outside of the Mormon cultural region, Mormon idiosyncrasies were far more likely to be tolerated and even admired in business than in politics. At the same time, the rise of the correlation movement within the church did even more to circumscribe women's lives into the domestic sphere, because the social work they had done through the church was subsumed into the priesthood organizational structure. By the late 1970s, Mormons who had a century before made domestic arrangements the defining characteristic of their civic engagement had made devotion to a rarefied isolationist domesticity a political statement. The effective sum of these changes was a retreat to domesticity, the creation of a discourse about home as a refuge from the world. Zion shrank to the size of a suburban colonial with a half-acre lot in a good school district. There are a few hiccups, a little blip of Mormon feminism that was essentially eradicated in the early 90s, a generation of women polarized over the ERA and its aftermath. But as President Hinckley once pointed out to a reporter in an atypically cynical moment, the church was baptizing huge numbers of women in more conservative cultures for every one uppity American woman who let go of the iron rod. Moreover, the entire culture of the U.S. was fragmenting over social issues, so if Mormons are no longer out-Americaning all the Americans, they do find a very comfortable place in the ranks of the culture warriors on the right. And gays and lesbians arrive just after feminists as convenient public enemy number one. Proposition 8 wins, Mormon mommy blogs garner national attention for being so adorably wholesome, and a few colorful outliers are trotted, some of whom are in this room, are trotted out as evidence of how comfy and wonderful Mormonism is for all kinds of people, and all is well in Zion. Except, of course, that it isn't. A new generation of girls has grown up with the benefits of feminism solidly established. It no longer seems controversial to them that they should enjoy the same education and employment opportunities as men. In fact, they come of age in an educational system in which women now routinely outperform men by almost all measures. Commitment to motherhood is strenuously enforced in the Young Women's Program. I said beaten into them, but that's a little too strong. proclamation on the family now appears in almost every single category of values that the young women are supposed to set goals in. It figures prominently as something that they're supposed to refer to, memorize, or practice elements of in every area of their aspirational religious lives. Many of them have barely heard the word housewife. It doesn't make sense to them. Mormon mommy blogging is mostly not evidence of spiritual conviction, but of lifestyle choice. Here's an excerpt from a recent Salon article extolling the delights of Mormon mommy blogs. Quote, "At first glance, Naomi and Stacy and Stephanie and Liz appear to be members of the species known as the hipster mommy blogger, though perhaps a bit more cheerful and wholesome than most, differing from the world in happy ways. They have bangs like Zooey Deschanel and closets full of cool vintage dresses. Their houses look like Anthropology catalogs. Their kids look like Baby Gap models. Their husbands look like young graphic designers, all cute lumberjack shirts and square-framed glasses. They spend their days doing fun craft projects, vintagey owl throw pillow, recycled button earrings, hand-stabbed linen napkins. They spend their weekends throwing big, whimsical dinner parties for their friends, all of whom have equally adorable kids and husbands. But as you page through their blog archives, you notice certain tells. They're super young, like four kids at 29 young. They mention relatives in Utah. They drink a suspicious amount of hot chocolate. Finally, you see it, a subtly placed widget with a picture of the temple or a hyperlink on the word faith or belief. You click the link and up pops the official website of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So the church has been quite successful in making one particular form of family life, that is, the husband-wife with the wife at home with children, the central commitment of young Mormon adults. But unlike, say, conservative evangelical Christians who wrote the Prairie Muffin Manifesto, do it. Any of you know the Prairie Muffin Manifesto? Google it when you get home. It's delightful.
Or don't. It's horrifying.
Well, let me just read you a few of their points, because it's important to understand this as a very religiously articulated commitment to homemaking, which I think we kind of lack in Mormonism, or it's not as specific. Here's what they say. Prairie Muffins. I could explain the name, but it would take too long. Anyway, they are committed to obeying God's law in every area of life as they are aware of its application to their lives and circumstances. They are helpmeets to their husbands, seeking creative and practical ways to further their husbands' callings and aid them in their dominion responsibilities. They are aware that God is in control of their ability to conceive and bear children, and they are content to allow him to bless them as he chooses in this area. They are creative, learning new skills and working with their hands to provide items of beauty as well as utility for their families. So there's that radical homemaking. They do not reflect badly on their husbands by neglecting their appearance. They work with the clay God has given, molding it into an attractive package for the pleasure of their husbands. But here's a less amusing but more important one. They appreciate godly role models such as Anne Bradstreet, Elizabeth Prentice, and Elizabeth Elliot. They do not idolize Laura Ingalls Wilder of Little House on the Prairie books or Louisa May Alcott, Little Women. While they may enjoy aspects of the home life presented in those books, Prairie Muffins understand that the latent humanism and feminism in these stories and in the lives of these women is not worthy of emulation. Yeah, so that's really different from the way that Mormons talk about the exact same form of family, the ideal of the mother at home with children. So Mormon women, by and large, have no particularly Mormon rationale for their choices. They are encouraged to be educated and in many ways to participate in modern economies and social structures along with their husbands. One blogger all too aptly described Mormon rhetoric about male headship as chicken patriarchy. What Mormon mommy blogs do clearly demonstrate is an embrace of American consumer culture and the Generation Y commitment to self-expression. Mormonism is a part of these bloggers' personal brand to the extent that their chosen lifestyles mirror the post-70s LDS commitment to a particular family form. Note that in the excerpt above from Salon, the information about Mormonism is found in subtly placed widgets or a hyperlink on some innocuous term like faith. What this similarity with other lifestyle blogs suggests, to me at least, is that Mormons are at a moment of low tension with surrounding society. We actually have to manufacture the tension with rhetoric about the family being under siege, which requires ignoring statistics like declining divorce, teen pregnancy, and abortion rates, increasing numbers of women leaving the workforce to care for children, progressive employer support for family-friendly policies, including maternity and paternity leave. This lack of optimal tension with the surrounding society allows differences between Mormons to arise, as in the 60s when Moss notes the variation in Mormon political convictions. Without clearly defined external threats, circling the wagons will inevitably draw circles that include some self-identified group members who sympathize with different kinds of out-group members. So we get these internal tensions by trying to create external tensions. However, lacking the theological and communitarian elements of resistance to American modernity, the public and male elements of early Mormon resistance, this increasingly public domesticity may lack the necessary ideological underpinning to really create boundaries for Mormons. The confusion over the theological justification for valorizing stay-at-home motherhood is evident in the divided sphere of Mormon women's personal writings on blogs, particularly. And here are just a few examples. I am not a feminist because I don't support, look fondly on, hope for, or work towards equality. Equality, that's my hang-up. Equality has never done any good for me. When I try to look at the world with my equalizer glasses, it leaves me empty and upset. Equality presents a scale and binds you, and life is not fair, so how can it be equal? But even if it could, I don't want to be equal to the males in my life. I just want to be me. If that means I'm more, then I'm more. If that means I'm less, I'm less. But most of the time, I think I am more, and I think most women are too. Or, here's another quote from another blog. Basically, I don't choose to use the term feminism for myself because the term daughter of God suffices, more than suffices, to produce something inside of me that is ultimately commanding. And to that end, I also believe that any woman who was, has been, and will be inspired to bring about the betterment of the female life was also directed by God. I acknowledge the efforts made by these women, tough decisions and radical thinking, for the good they have done. I believe they were inspired by personal and powerful revelation, not feminism per se. Apparently, regardless of what they said. Ultimately, I believe being a Mormon female, along with all the covenants, promises, and oaths I've made, supersedes the feminism agenda. And sometimes I worry that if my fellow saints get too engaged in what is and what isn't a Mormon feminist, they miss the whole glory of being a Mormon woman. And speaking of the confusion on the other side of Mormon women who do self-identify as feminists, religious studies scholar Melissa Proctor wrote, she's talking about this group called WAVE, which is women advocating for voice inequality. Is that right?
Yeah.
WAVE explicitly identifies itself as feminist by virtue of a stated commitment to gender equality, but also asserts that being feminist and faithful are not mutually exclusive. Their website indicates that WAVE hopes to make changes to policy and practice that do not require doctrinal variation, and that its primary purpose is to uplift and support women. It's unfortunate that these discussions always so unfortunately evoke lingerie ads. Such a gentle, almost pastoral Mormon feminism seems unlikely to evoke outrage or result in ecclesiastical discipline. No doubt this gradual incrementalist approach to increase gender equality in the church has strategic advantages compared with outright defiance of church leadership. But as it is described, one wonders what concrete goals the organization hopes to achieve. This confused and confusing rhetoric will persist and even remain necessary as long as tension with the surrounding culture is generated by privileging certain forms of family life without clearly articulating a doctrinal rationale, and while nominally allowing different choices between equally worthy women. One example is Elder Cook's recent conference talk, in which he seemed to suggest that they really mean it when they say that different choices are acceptable for faithful women. He did still, however, use economic necessity as the only stated justification for a mother choosing to be employed outside the home. Two things could change this confusion. The less likely possibility, I think, would be for Mormonism to decrease emphasis on a particular family form as absolutely central to Mormon identity. This might make it possible for a broader range of young Mormon women to incorporate Mormonism as an element of their personal identity, but probably at the expense of some Mormon distinctiveness. Alternatively, we might try to articulate a more robust theology of patriarchy. It seems quite possible that many young Mormon women's loyalty would extend to embrace male headship without the elastic help each other as equal partners clause. But these are the conversations that we need to have. We need to talk seriously about the language of men presiding in the home and either get serious about it and embrace it. We need to talk about why helping each other as equal partners is the ideal for home life but is never modeled in church governance. We need to figure out whether encouraging women to stay home with their children has to do merely with what we regard as women's nature or whether we mean it as a mode of resistance to assimilation. We need to make some attempt to explain why, if women staying at home with children is God's eternal ideal, it has been limited to a few relatively brief historical moments, and why it is a choice available only to the rich. The superficiality of our discourse around these topics suggests that we are terrified of them. Even women willing to be far more open than has been typical about their personal experience as Mormon women are extremely hesitant to generalize. Indeed, an LDS women's publication called Segula, which has carefully branded itself as more orthodox than Exponent 2 and other publications, has published on topics like plastic surgery. It published the only Mormon poem that contains the word boob job, as far as I know. frustration with the stay-at-home motherhood role, chafing at Mormon cultural expectations for women, etc. But it has an explicit editorial policy of not allowing authors to move from describing their personal experience to articulating criticism of the institution. That is, it's okay to say, I was sad that I had to watch from the pew as my baby was blessed, but it is not okay to say, I think women should be able to participate in blessing their infants. Indeed, saying, of course I'm not agitating for women's ordination, or I wouldn't want the priesthood, is a necessary, even reflexive caveat to any statement suggesting that one might desire fuller participation for women in any aspect of church life. Discussions of women's roles in formal church settings, and even in private conversations and online forums, devolve into a ritualized performance of norms of femininity and righteousness, requiring a studied placement of interlocutors into a rubric of political and theological commitments, where women who favor the status quo regard differing opinions as moral lapses, and women who seek change regard difference as evidence of ignorance. If questions that underlie conflict between Mormon women, if doctrinal discussion remains off limits, and especially if we fail to engage the real questions that underlie conflict between Mormon women over these questions, preferring to see women's different choices as evidence of individual failure to adequately perform sentimentalized cultural notions of femininity that are neither scripturally warranted nor theologically justified, we will continue to lose the talents and gifts Mormon women might contribute if they were not busy arguing over a chronically moribund Mormon feminism that makes occasional Monty Python-esque protestations of renewed vitality and perambulatory intent. Worse, we risk losing sight of what home must mean to 21st century saints. If instead of thinking long and carefully about home as a locus of resistance to the excesses of materialism the Book of Mormon warns against, thinking of homemaking as part of a larger project that belongs equally to saints of both genders in diverse marital and familial situations, if instead of doing that, we reduce homemaking to the performance of certain retro-inflected femininity that harkens back to the post-war moment when American advertisers constructed the housewife as consumer-in-chief, we will find ourselves using our cute, vintagey, hand-stamped linen handkerchief to wipe away the tears we will weep for Zion.
Good morning still. It's an honor to speak here today. I'm going to be speaking from a very personal perspective on the issue of homemaking. I thought some context would be in order. From the moment I was born, let's see, did it work?
Yeah, there you go.
I was a little different. I'm not just talking about the leopard print onesie. No, from a very early age, I was a little particular. When I finally came out to my mom, that's me. When I came out to my mom a few years back, my mom's response was a simple, "Huh, I always thought your brother was the gay one." And I'm like, are you kidding me? When I came out to my sister, though, this one, she said flatly that she'd known since I was 3. So I was born gay. But if that was all I had to say, there'd be absolutely no reason for me to present here. Our panel isn't about orientation. It's about new and different home economies. Home economies that address new and different realities. So let me talk a little bit about the home I grew up in. I was my mother's 4th and final child, and the man holding me in this picture was my mother's 6th husband. There we go. 6th, yeah. So my mom collected husbands like some people collect stray cats. So she'd bring them home, wash them up, and do her best to domesticate them. But if they peed on the carpet or otherwise misbehaved, they'd be asked to leave. So number one sired my brother. Number two adopted him. Number three sired my oldest sister. Number four sired my younger sister. Number five, well, he apparently did work. There we go. He was impotent. Number six sired me, and number seven adopted me.
Were there more?
Nope, that's it. Lucky number seven, they were married for 21 years. Yeah, number six sired me, and after abusing my mom and my siblings, he was escorted out of the house by men in uniform. I was 5 and a half at the time. Number seven entered the scene when I was 10, and he adopted me when I was 13. He and my mom were married for 21 years, and he died on my mother's birthday in 2003. Strangely enough, most of the men listed here are dead. She didn't kill any of them that I know of. So, abuse, physical, sexual, and psychological were part of our lives growing up. I was fortunate in that I escaped the worst of the abuse. So it should be no surprise that my siblings and I put a lot of energy into escaping home life. My brother escaped into computers, cross-country, and school life. My oldest sister escaped into her life with friends, church roadshows, and
study abroad.
Study abroads in Mexico during high school. My second sister escaped, period. Running away at the tender age of 8, falling into drugs and prostitution. She died on the streets at 17. And me, well, I escaped into choir and debate and the LDS Church and all the things that it offered. My oldest sister and I are the only Mormons. Of course, that's a story for another time. All right, so my homemaking efforts began at an early age in a very literal way. There were weekly 4-hour long grass mowing ritual, the monthly bedroom redecorations, the occasional redecoration of the rest of the house, and one sunny afternoon, an impromptu home remodeling project that involved some light demolition. I didn't get permission. It looked a lot better afterwards, though. But there's also a sense of homemaking that we're talking about here today, the purposeful making of one's home life. This more figurative homemaking manifested itself in my daily trips through my neighborhood and to the world beyond, during which I looked for people who would let me into their homes and into their lives. Newlyweds, young couples with small families, retirees, Mormon mega families. These are the Jorgensons, a family from church that took me in. I love these people and love them still. And they have no idea how much their being in my life meant to me. So what was I looking for in these trips? What were the qualities of home that I was looking for? Safety. And being needed and appreciated, loved, people to love, being out of my head, finding counsel givers and secret keepers. We all want to be safe from physical harm, from ridicule, sometimes even from our own selves. Needed and appreciated doesn't need explanation. We want people in our lives who have our best interests of heart, of course. And if we're well-adjusted, we have profound need to love others. But you can't love, nurture, whatever, everyone, not in this deeper sense. This deeper sense requires a sort of mutual commitment. So, on being out of my head, it's an unfortunate turn of phrase, but it's the best one I could come up with. Human beings are inherently self-centered, and that's not a qualitative assessment, that's a geospatial one. When I wake up in the morning, I ask, what am I going to do today? Even the most altruistic person in the world wakes up in the morning, what do they say? What am I going to do today for somebody else? So human beings are inherently self-centered. But marriage and family life gets us out of that. It's suddenly we and they. In looking for family and in creating my own ad hoc families, I was looking for people to take me out of my head, out of the I and into the we and they territories. So, about counsel givers and secret keepers. We live in a supremely political world. Child, adult, it doesn't matter. We are constantly weighing where we are in our relationships to others, the importance of words, of body language, and it's in this environment that it's extremely important that we have allies. Someone who will call us out on our BS or tell us when we are being walked over by the people in our lives. They're extremely important in regulating our beliefs and in our fears. These people are our secret keepers and our counselors. Without counselors and secret keepers, we struggle to make sense of our emotions and our place in the world. We struggle to thrive. Let's fast forward to adulthood. As a young BYU student and a freshly returned missionary, I knew what my next assignment was. Marriage. So I began dating in earnest. I hadn't really dated before. Yeah, sure, I went to prom. That's me with the bishop's daughter. Don't judge me, it was the 80s. So there was the prom, but they didn't really count, these dates. For all intents and purposes, my first real dates happened at BYU. And at BYU, I dated a lot. But they were mostly first dates, for obvious reasons. I recall a handful of seconds and no thirds. But they were all with amazing women. So this was taken on our way back to Provo from a lovely dinner up in Park City. My favorite first date. I had favorite first dates. But let's face it, none of these relationships were going anywhere, and every date felt like I was out with my sister. I couldn't give up hope. I kept on looking for that one girl that would with whom I could make a home. So here's a quick story. I'm living in this apartment just off campus, and I've been living there for about 2 or 3 years when a rumor that I was gay swept through the ward, and it was not exactly a good week for me. I wasn't ready to come out of the closet, and frankly, I'd only just come out of the closet to myself a few weeks earlier. Anyway, the rumor mill was on overdrive, and then one evening, one of my roommates, Mark, God bless Mark, came up to me and he pulls me aside and he says, "You know, I told the guys, our roommates, I told the guys that they're crazy to think you're gay because, well, you date more than all of us put together." I didn't have the heart to break it to him, but that the rumors were true. But he was a sweet man. I really appreciate it. And as I was dating all these women, I was going about a very real form of homemaking, a rather traditional form of homemaking, especially for guys at BYU, fresh off their missions. But looking back, I can honestly say that I wasn't so much looking for a wife as I was looking for a new family. I was looking for, of all the girls I dated, the ones that stand out the most were the ones with bustling families of their own. Families I could adopt and who, if everything went according to plan, would adopt me. But all that came to an end in 1998, 5 years after I started BYU. It was a beautiful sunny day. We have lots of those here in Utah. And I was at work in my cubicle. And I had, as best as I can describe, a waking dream. It was of me, some of imagined future me. And I was sitting in my backyard, and I was sitting along a little stream going through the backyard. And I could see vaguely off in the background my wife working at the barbecue grill up by the back of the house. And there is my little boy, beautiful little boy, sitting next to me, and we're talking. And he looks up to me and he says, "Daddy, why did you marry Mom?" And I looked at him and said, "So I could have you." And that was the end of the dream. As I was sitting there in my cubicle, in tears, the thought that I'd marry someone just so I could have a child horrified me. And needless to say, I stopped dating women. And that's when my homemaking plans took an abrupt turn. It didn't occur to me then, though it's occurred to me numerous times since, to just leave the church and find a husband, to hop, as it were, a different train running in roughly the same direction. But that wasn't really an option, and still isn't. Not really. Not for me. So where does a man in search of family go? How was I to go about making a home for myself in this new reality? How was I ever to find what I was looking for? These qualities of home. That dream happened 13 years ago, and at the time I was still living with roommates at BYU. Within the year, I'd buy my own home, not far from BYU. But even in this new place, I still had roommates. But how well did it meet my needs? Here's what I would say my average BYU roommate situation looked like. So, safety, needed and appreciated, I cleaned a lot. Loved, people to love, yeah, they weren't the greatest. Out of my head, yeah, these two are really highly correlated. Council givers and secret keepers. No secret keepers there. During the same time, I was attending the family ward. I skipped a little bit. So here we have a decent situation. It's not perfect, but it's not acceptable, certainly not long term. But it did work for me. For a little more than 6 years, it worked. Though, frankly, as my roommates got older and more marriage-focused, it became harder and harder to look to them for anything beyond a good morning. Near the end of my time in Provo, it became very evident that I'd have to look elsewhere for my ad hoc family. All right, so here's what my quality of home looked like towards the end. So during the same time, I was attending a family ward where my home was located. It was a hard ward to live in. There was no unity. The bishopric seemed distracted and overworked. And except for a few amazing families, the members of the ward were just passing through. I was called as ward chorister, but my efforts in that calling were constantly second-guessed. But the real blow for me was that there was no real elders quorum to speak of. We had a class of elders, but not a quorum. So as my roommate situation was deteriorating and my ward family was not really picking up the slack. So I sold my home in Provo and I moved to Salt Lake City, and I wasn't going to make the same mistake twice. I first found a ward I loved and then bought a home in the ward. And for me, that was right downtown. In this ward, the bishoprics have been able to balance the near-crushing demands of welfare seekers and the social and spiritual needs of the congregations. I've had callings that were matched to my abilities and my interests, and I've been part of an active and engaging elders quorum. And here's how my current ward stacks up. Okay. I feel safe, needed and appreciated, loved. There are people to love. Still not out of my head. There still aren't people that just capture my imagination where, you know, I'm at work and I'm like, I wonder how so-and-so's doing. Council givers and secret keepers. Still not there. At this time, like I said, I stopped dating women. A few years later, I decided to start dating men. So, qualities of the men I date. Safety, needed and appreciated, loved, let's see, not so much. It's a lot of first dates. People to love, there's some good guys out there. Out of my head, absolutely. Dating is a blast. And you ask somebody out on a date, and for the next 2 weeks you're thinking about, you know, what should we do, how much fun it'll be, you know, what can I do to make it really interesting, I wonder what they're doing, I wonder what they're thinking. So, yeah, I'm out of my head. And then counsel givers and secret keepers, no. Because once again, that takes a commitment. And dating isn't a commitment. So, so let's look at those combined. And so it's not entirely additive. Okay? And what you don't see, though, is that it's horribly diffuse. This shows the disparate experiences spread among maybe 1,000 people. Okay? So, you know, all the people in my ward and all the people I date slowly, you know, add up to something like that. But that's not really an option either. Homemaking is an iterative and eternal experience. For me, it's the quest to either find my counsel giver and seeker keeper or to learn to do without. For those of you who found your family, it's the quest to perfect it. To, as I've said elsewhere, trudge towards perfection. It's all about thriving. Because that's what life is about. Man is that he might have joy. I am available if you want to plug into my continuing adventures. My dating adventures included. You're welcome to. Thank you.
Well, we started with Plato, and we went with Christine's laser-like precision, and then Christian's personal story, and I'm the mop-up, and I always tell the personal story. It's what I do. I tell the personal narrative. I'm a mommy blogger. I'm one of the things that Christine, but I'm not. I have a little widget on my sidebar, but it takes you to my I Am Mormon profile where I talk about my divorce and my conversion and the loss of my family and the burning down and the ashes that were left behind when my husband chose to look for salvation in the bottom of a pill bottle. I don't write posts about stamping napkins. I did once upon a time.
Not that there's anything wrong with
that. No, there's not. There's totally not. And I gotta tell you, I have the hand-stamped napkins in my bureau from my old life before what I thought I wanted burned down. I have all that stuff. And that's actually what my story is about today. It's about having that post-colonial on 2 acres and realizing that when it was all gone, I still had a home. Homemaking doesn't have to be about having what looks like it should be. All I ever wanted to be was a mother growing up. It was what I aspired to. I was not raised in the church. I'm an adult convert. I joined when I was 29, 9 years ago. But I grew up in a very, very traditional environment that would be completely recognizable to anyone who did grow up in Happy Valley. My mother canned all of our food. She baked granola from scratch. We had fruit trees and vegetable garden. And in her house, hanging on a wall, is a picture of me when I'm about 5 years old. It's summertime, and the fruit trees are in the background, and the dogs are laying on the grass. And I've got chicken pox, and I'm covered with dots of calamine lotion. And under, I have a slip on, just a slip and nothing else. But shoved under my slip, I have a volleyball. And I'm standing sideways pretending that I'm pregnant. I was 4. It was what I wanted to do with my life. It was my entire trajectory for where I was going. My mom was the PTA president. She never missed school meetings. I mean, she did everything that a good Mormon mother could tick off, only she was a California hippie liberal, and we sometimes didn't wear clothes. And while I'm part of one now, I didn't grow up in this conservative religious background. My parents did have that traditional middle class, mom stays at home, dad goes to work, mom has the babies. That's what I grew up. I did have friends who had parents who were not living that ideal. I had friends whose parents were divorced. But those houses were peculiar. I remember going over there as a kid thinking, it was kind of odd. You know, the mom would come in her high heels and they would clack on the floor. Well, my mom was always barefoot. I distinctly remember that distinction as a little kid. I didn't know much. No one told me anything, but I picked on the cultural and social bias that working moms were not as good as those moms who stayed at home, even in Northern California where I grew up, you know, in the 70s and early 80s. They weren't as righteous as my mom, who stayed home and grew granola on the peach tree in the backyard. those biases were internalized in me really, really young, without, you know, my making a choice on that. And they influenced the choices that I did make in my life a great deal. As I entered my teen years, I was plagued by directionlessness and elusive desires that I couldn't stick to a course of interest for very long. I would try one thing and set it down. I would try another thing and set it down. The truth was I wanted to be barefoot and pregnant. And that was horrifying to the women friends that I had and the feminists who I was starting to hang with, that I would want to be barefoot and pregnant. How could I? How could I? I distinctly remember at one of my first jobs, one of the women that I worked with, when I told her what I wanted to do, just looked at me like I had killed a baby. I mean, she just... And she really put me down for that. But I felt like I was a natural-born mother. I felt like it was what I was called to do from birth. And I felt that that fulfillment would clarify and coalesce my life if I could get there, get married, have that baby, I would be fulfilled. I would have all the things that I had always wanted. I was trying to recreate the rose-colored memories from my childhood. I think that anyone who comes from a happy home innately tries to recreate it. We don't need to have necessarily even a conscious discourse about it. If you come from a happy home, you're going to try to replicate it in whatever way you can in your own life. When I got married at 27, I was the first of my friends who were married, and they were all perplexed as to why I would do something like get married. I lived in San Francisco. 27, most of my Mormon friends now at 27 already had 3 kids. My first baby came at 29, and I was also the first of all of my friends to have a child. At 30, I found the church, and I got baptized. It was shocking and exhilarating to find an entire subculture devoted to what I had always wanted to do. I dove in with everything I had. I did. I felt like I had found my home. I had found my element. I had found where I belonged. And I have, but it wasn't what I thought it was going to be. My desires to make home were not only lauded, they were sanctified and matted and framed. 3 more babies came in 4 years, and I devoted myself to making the home I had always wanted. And really, frankly, I was good at it. This is when I started blogging. I started blogging between my second and third child. And when my blog started out, if you go back and read, the bones of who I was going to become were already there, but I was doing the stamp napkins. I was doing the all the things that I felt like a good Mormon girl should do, because I was adopting it with gusto. All the pretty pieces were in place until they weren't anymore. The forms were there, but the heart of what I thought my home was turned to ashes when my husband decided he was going to be a drug addict, and I found myself losing home. We lost our home. We lost our retirement, our 401k. We lost everything we had spent 10 years building, and I found myself with just me and my children. Well, when your entire identity is based on these outward manifestations, you know, who are you then, and what is home? Where does home come from when what you thought was home is gone? You know, once upon a time, I was like so many women of conservative faiths and others who gave up my career to stay at home with young children. I devoted myself to making my home special and beautiful, and it wasn't just enjoyable, it was my calling, it was my life. From where I stand now, all of that stuff might still be important. Those mommy blogs that are doing that may very well be serving an important function. But from where I step now, from where I'm at now, my priorities have seismically shifted. And making wreaths from old book pages, which you can find a tutorial on my old blog how to do, it feels not only frivolous, but it feels downright vain. And I just can't do it anymore.
I did it.
Did you use one? I have one in my kitchen still. These are the activities of luxury. They truly are. They are the activities of a woman who knows the mortgage is paid. and her heat and grocery bills are taken care of by someone else. They are the activities of a woman taken care of by her husband, whose sole joy is to make the home a refuge of the world. That is the place of privilege. And I'm not knocking her, because I used to be her. Only now my face is on the other side of the glass, because it all got taken away. Which is totally okay. It's not sad, even though initially it started out feeling sad. I look at those women with their pretty lives and their pretty napkins now. And I'm just on the outside looking in. What was once a bastion of comfort and security is now a reminder of how tenuous a woman's traditional position is when she gives up her career, she gives up her education, and she chooses to stay home. What happens when person B, who's supposed to be right here next to you, abdicates? Where does she go? How contingent her safety is, and her comfort, and even her identity is on someone outside herself. So I'm going to read you an excerpt, actually, from my blog from when all of this was happening. The inky words swim before my filling eyes. My nerves are shot and frayed like a tiny jumble of thready copper wires on a blown electric socket. If you had metaphysical eyes, black ashes and smoke would have left a ghost flame on the wall behind me. I am losing my home. My kids are healthy. We have good schools. We have a car that works. We have food in the pantry, and we have water and heat and love still. We are going to be okay. I am losing my home. How long have I told myself that things were going to work out? How long have I clung to the fragile bubble of hope? If I lose my home, do I also lose my good schools, my warmth, and my pantry? Does it get so bad that thinking at least my kids aren't terminally ill is the best that I can come up with? Yeah, some days it does. Am I then taunting God to dig out the really big guns and just dump the rest of what's left in the bucket on me? Because at this point, if it's really going to suck more, can we please just get it over with? I'm not a victim. I'm not powerless. But damn it, none of this is my fault. I sound like a petulant child, but it's true. Everything I've had to live through in the last 3 years has been because of the choices of another. And now even my home is going to be taken from me. What am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to do? And how do I tell my children? How do I tell them without my anger and sadness spilling over? How do I do this? I am finally, utterly, and completely at a loss. Yesterday flattened me. Yesterday had me looking at the smoldering wreckage of the life I had planned for, the life I wanted, and the life holding the fragrant cedar chest of my hopes. And it forced me to see that it is gone. The house in which I had planned on raising my children, growing older and genteel, and becoming a grandmother, is now another casualty of agency and addiction. It hurts. I am grieving for these hopes, for the millions of futures I will no longer have. It feels like being kicked in the chest, and you curl up as the waves of icy hot pain radiate from your heart. You can't do a damn thing except wait for it to pass. But a strange thing happened. The worst has come to pass. I have lost my marriage. I have lost my best friend. I have lost the promises and hopes of a future I wished mightily to have. I lost a co-parent and love. I lost financial security, savings, retirement, my good credit, health insurance. I'm going to have to, through no fault of my own, let my home go as well. I find myself pulling my mid-30s with the future laying before me. Only a few things really matter: my children's health and safety, finding a way to support us. That's it. Everything else is frosting. It's an oddly free feeling. My legs are shaking as I pull myself up yet again. But the flame of hope is kindled strong, still, and calm deep inside. The task lies before me to pack the home now, the house of dreams where I plan to spend the rest of my life and sort, divide, donate, and sell. I am choosing to do it. I am choosing to take my kids and myself out of this situation that is beyond my control. I am choosing to wrench the bull by the horns and wrestle that sucker to the floor. Because of choices my ex-husband make, I cannot keep my home. The struggle of coming to terms with it has been a bed of hard, sharp rocks. But ultimately, it is simply the truth. A single mother, supporting her children by herself, does not have the luxury of holding on to old constructs of home. The paradigm has shifted. The hard part is the dissolution of dreams, the hopes and plans for a future that seemed so secure, so idyllic, so perfect, and so much the fulfillment of everything is gone. There is a gasping chasm of perfect pain where my heart was, but that life is gone, and I cannot bring it back. Hiding from those truths will only hurt more. I took the kids to see what I am calling our little house, and they're okay with it. They don't notice the things like linoleum floors and think that sharing a bathroom will just make Sunday chores go, or Saturday chores go faster. Mm-hmm. Cleaning four bathrooms does take some time, and who needs a walk-in and who needs two master walk-in closets anyway? Gleaming hardwood floors are hard to keep clean, and my Dyson needed carpet anyway. My cheeks sting, and I feel ashamed of my pride and ashamed that I am not more grateful for the new small house. My emotions are close to the surface. When I met with my attorney, it was like ripping open a sutured wound. When the severing you have come to terms with intellectually is all laid out before you on paper. I thought I was ready, but the actuality of seeing your life, your heart, your best friend, your children, your home, laid bare in legal terms on stark white paper, nothing can prepare you for it. Packing my home feels like undressing the dead. Taking the pictures off the wall and clearing the mantle, disrobing, and making a blank canvas against, again, upswells all the sediment from the bottom of the well. All the hopes and joys that I felt while unpacking, while settling in my beautiful home, now rise on the gentle swirl of sorrow and the tide. It's not cruel or malicious, it just is. It seems almost gently mindful of my sorrow as it swells up and breaks the surface of the water to float away on the cool winter sunlight. Tears dry in tight trails on my cheeks, and time rolls on. No matter where, no matter how much you love your home and think it's where your heart is, it's not. Your home is an empty shell, a vacant lot without those you love lighting its walls. The old adage got it wrong. Your home is in your heart, not the other way around. So what I've learned from this is that this ideal that we espouse, these platitudes that we have framed on our walls as saints, they don't mean anything. Your home has to do with who you are and what you make of yourself. And it's something you recreate every day. It can't be taken from you. It's a constant evolution of your spirit and your soul as you move through life. A woman at church told me last week that she was complaining of her life, that she thought of me and realized how great her life was. I wish I was kidding. She's my visiting teacher. She had no idea what her words did to me. She sat on my couch, and she was meaning to be quite complimentary, I'm sure. My life is not an object lesson in failure because my Norman Rockwell picture blew up. What should be ridiculously obvious, but apparently is not, is that being a Mormon is not about what your family looks like or what circumstances this earthly life has placed in your path. Being a Mormon is about being a part of something that is indescribably beautiful. It is about a change in your heart and a change that may have taken you entirely by surprise. It may have been years in the making or it may have been sudden. Becoming a Latter-day Saint begins in a million different ways with a million different trajectories. But it ends up with us looking at one another and seeing the reflection of God in each other's faces. That is what it means to be a Mormon. I think we forget this sometimes. We forget in our individual myopia that we are all woven together, that we don't just seal this idealized 1950s nuclear family together. We seal all of humanity together. That is the ultimate goal. And the fact that my family has now shifted and no longer looks like the 1950s family, it's me and my kids on a life raft, we are still woven together and sealed into that web. We are still just as much a part of the family of God. It is the utterly breathtaking goal of our faith to seal the family of humanity together forever, to progress and to learn and to be like God. For us, salvation is a collective communion. Home is not a place. Homemaking is not a destination. Home resides within us. In a perfect sphere where no one can take it away and no one can decoupage or cover it in chintz florals or frame it in clunky oak or brass. Home is that deep stirring of happiness that comes from knowing who you are and claiming yourself. The rest of it just falls by the wayside in the light of something so vast and awe-inspiring. I'm worthy in every way to claim my faith, no matter what my family looks like, and I choose to make it look. Home is right here. Sure.
I know. And you know, we're fresh out of time. There's not a lot to... well, I mean, the panel raises a lot of interesting questions, I think, for us to think about as a community. You know, what is the nature? How are we going to define the nature of our ourselves and our relationships with other people? How do ideals about the home and about family participate in the sociology of religious community and boundary maintenance? What happens when? How does one appropriately pursue homemaking when one does not fit the traditional model, when one finds oneself standing outside of what's defined as normal? And perhaps the increasingly relevant question of how you maintain a sense of home, a sense of family identity, when you know, when the rug is pulled out from underneath you and when everything changes. And I think the one common theme in all this is the question of how our active, conscious shaping of our home lives, of our family relationships, of our home economies positions us in the world. How does it define where we sit and our interaction, our engagement with the world? I don't know if there's anybody feels like they want to ask a super pressing question before we close things up, but...
what's your blog's name?
Me? Well, I write for several. My personal blog is Dandelion Mama. I write for Mormon Mommy Wars, and I also am a perma for the last 5 years at By Common Consent.
That's it. I just want to really thank all the panelists and just tell you what a privilege it's been to be a part of this.